Good afternoon. This is a podcast runs through it. We're in Sound Color Studios here in Livingston, and today something for us a little bit different. We're going to be talking with an author. His name is John Clayton, and he's in town to, he's working at the schools, and he'll be talking to us, and he'll be going over to the Elk River Bookstore, and he has a new book. It's called Natural Rivals, the story of John Muir and Gifford Pinchot. It has a lot to do with our area of the world and conservation, national forests, that sort of thing. I think you'll find the interview very interesting. I'm here with Dixie Hart.
Good afternoon.
And she's almost asleep, but I wake her up once in a while. Anyway, it should be an interesting conversation. And
fun fact, the first railroad siding west of Livingston is called Muir.
Well, if you look in the mirror, that's what you see.
On that note. I think this is what you would call a derailment.
So
it's gone off the rails.
On that note, without further discussion or levity, let's get on to the interview. Good afternoon. This is a podcast runs through it. I'm Nelson King along with Dixie Hart, and today we're going to be interviewing an author, which is something we haven't done before, and we're very happy to get started with this. His name is John Clayton. You may have heard of him. He's from this area. Actually, lives in Red Lodge now, right?
Yeah.
And John has a new book. Well, not exactly new. I think it came out in, August of last year? Published. But you're in town here in Livingston to, I think you were at the high school.
And I'm at Elk River Books tonight.
So we're happy you could spare us a few minutes to come in. I know it's been a busy day, and there's a few other things going on in the world. So, but we're here to talk in part about the book. It's called Natural Rivals. That's a very important title because it really does reveal what's kind of in the book. But the two names associated with it, the subtitle is John Muir, Gifford Pinchot, and The Creation of America's Public Lands.
I'm so glad you remembered that subtitle because I actually have a macro to just insert it manually. I can never quite remember all the details.
Yeah, well, it's like a lot of stuff.
And you wrote it.
I don't know. Well, I'm sure we will talk about this with John, but the name's John Muir. Probably many people have heard of him. A lot of people haven't heard of Gifford Pinchot, and they are interesting, very interesting characters. And the very important thing about the book is how he uses their personalities and contrasts them in the context of conservation and the preservation of public lands in the United States. And I didn't ask you this before, but would you mind reading a paragraph from your book?
Oh, I'd be happy to, yeah.
Okay. The reason I want to do this is because you very well kind of outlined the key points in the book. If you can read that.
The real wonder of public lands is less about outcomes than it is about process. On public lands, we as a democratic society get to decide collectively what happens. We can come together to articulate our relationship to nature. Bike trail here, elk habitat there. Logging here, grazing there. Scenic pullout here, oil rig out of sight behind a hill. Even if putting together the jigsaw puzzle can feel like a tiresome chore, it's a privilege. And its results, though far from perfect, are almost always better than a pile of jumbled pieces. In short, although we often speak of public lands as if they're nature's lands, what makes them profound is that they're democracy's lands.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That brings up most of the key issues, I think, at least a lot of them. And I always like this because you're looking at actually kind of intellectual or whatever concepts, but bringing it to life through people. The story of two particular men who had a particular way of looking at these issues. And I'll let you get into, describing where you're coming from and why you settled on these two particular men.
To be honest, I started with the people. I ran across an account of Muir and Pinchot camped together on Lake McDonald in Glacier National Park in 1896, 15 years before it was a national park. And at first I thought, well, they're enemies. They must have been fighting. I could write a great book about their first argument on the shores of Lake McDonald. And then as I dug into it, I realized that they actually weren't fighting, that they were collaborating, that they were friends. And this ran contrary to everything I'd learned about Muir and Pinchot, preservation and conservation, those battles of environmental philosophy. And so I wanted to dig into them. And I was looking at writing some sort of dual biography, and I was struggling with, well, what is this really about? And then finally I paid attention to what I should have paid attention to originally. Why were they there at Lake McDonald? They were there because of a crisis in the idea of public lands, because of a political battle that was putting at risk all of the forest reserves that had been set aside to that point, and potentially even the national parks and other forms of public lands. And they united behind the idea of public lands. And I realized that, of course, that's something that's also a hot political topic today, and yet a topic that we don't know much about the origins of. Where had public lands come from? Did they come from John Muir and Gifford Pinchot? Suddenly, I had a question that could drive my book.
About what time? 1890s? What relative dates are we talking
Correct.
About?
Correct. Yeah, 1890s. Their camping trip was actually in 1896. But the first, a lot of people know that Yellowstone Park, especially around here, a lot of people know Yellowstone was the first national park in the world set aside in 1872. What a lot of people around here, even around Red Lodge, even south of Red Lodge, don't know is where was the world's first national forest? And let me sort of pause here. Do you know where the world's first national forest was? I didn't until doing this research. It was right next to the world's first national park. What is now the Shoshone Forest was set aside in 1891, 14 years before the Forest Service came into existence. You had this reserve. Yes, we want some sort of public land. Let's set this aside, but we don't really know what to do with it. And that lack of vision created a lot of political problems for the forest reserves and for public land in general. Through the 1890s, those problems were playing out in increasingly difficult ways until what's known as the 1897 Organic Act, I think it was, that Muir and Pinchot aligned together to get behind, that sort of set the policies for public lands.
Yeah, it was the, as you outlined in the book, quite well, it was that very often Congress would allocate these lands, and then because they were considered out in Indian country and in the wilderness, nobody gave a damn, right? It was, and then later, as the century rolled on, people started to want a homestead there, and they wanted to do mine and do other things in these same lands. And so you started to get conflict about, well, it's part of the national forest, but... And
exactly.
into that conflict steps these two men, right, which maybe you could give us a little bit of background. I'm, you know, assuming that people are not really familiar with them.
John Muir, perhaps the most famous naturalist in American history, known as a defender of Yosemite, really helped establish it as a national park. Also the founder of the Sierra Club, the nation's first grassroots environmental organization, did most of that work in the 1890s. Famous as an author, perhaps inventing today's genre of nature writing, with his marvelous books that are part travelogue, part description, part memoir, part sort of exhortation to get out and appreciate nature. Muir was an even better in-person storyteller with his Scottish brogue, and he would keep people stimulated and interested with his storytelling. So had a lot of adventures in that sense. And he is often portrayed in contrast to Gifford Pinchot. Pinchot was the founder of the U.S. Forest Service in 1905, an advisor to President Theodore Roosevelt, and also a close friend of Roosevelt's. They were cut from the same cloth, both wealthy, well-educated, outdoor-loving, East Coast privileged men. Pinchot wanted to be a statesman. He wanted to use the advantages that he had had to help the nation as a whole, including the common people. As Pinchot became the first forester, the first professional forester in America, he went to Europe to study forestry and came back to apply that for everyone, to save timber so that we would have enough wood in the future. For example, there was actually a fear in the 1890s that we would run out of trees to cut down. The timber industry had cut through the northern Midwest so quickly and was now setting its saws on the Pacific Northwest that people were debating, you know, gee, in 20 years we're going to have a timber famine. And Pinchot said, as a statesman, let's do something about this. Let's try to conserve some of these trees for the future. The market doesn't seem to be doing that very well. Maybe we need to investigate public ownership of some of these forests. Those preservation and conservation philosophies have a lot of similarities in that they're both set against the wanton exploitation of natural resources for immediate private gain. But they also have some conflicts with each other. If you're going to preserve a spot in nature, as John Muir would encourage you to do, you're going to sort of take a hands-off attitude. You're going to hope that it stays that way forever. You're not going to want to be cutting down trees or drilling for oil or making any big changes to that landscape. If you're going to conserve that landscape the way Pinchot would encourage you to do, yeah, you're going to cut a few trees this year. You're going to maybe allow some grazing. You're going to maybe allow some reservoirs, damming. You're going to use the resources, but use them responsibly, use them sustainably so that they can exist for future generations as well. And you're going to make sure that they're distributed to everybody and not just a small sliver of the wealthy population. And so when it comes to any specific piece of landscape, well, are we going to cut down this tree or are we not going to cut down this tree? The preservationists and the conservationists might disagree. And so that's why, I could picture these two guys gathered at Lake McDonald and Pinchot looking around and saying, you know, well, that would be a good grove to cut at first, and we could put the dam over here. And Muir would be like, no, don't touch it. It's so beautiful. That's the conflict that has played out within the environmental movement.
Right. It's still here. Absolutely. It's still here. Wilderness versus...
Every time there is a proposed new wilderness area, every time there's a proposed new drilling operation,
exactly.
Every time there's any new proposed use of public lands, we have this preservation versus conservation conflict.
Right. Now, the kind of interesting thing was that in one way, you can look at it as polar opposites, that Muir was a kind of a prophet.
Right.
And there was a heavy religious tone to the way he approached the wilderness, and it was certainly God in awe, and he was a poet, so that's what he was looking for purism in his wilderness, right? And Pinchot loved wilderness, but he also saw it as a kind of a compromise between man and nature, you know. Yeah. Totally different points of view, and yet they both loved wilderness and the out of doors and nature in that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So it makes a kind of interesting, throughout the book, you kind of draw on these parallel yet not parallel points of view, you know, because it is contemporary, very much so. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's. I often get frustrated with environmental politics because it seems to be this same argument playing out over and over again, and we seem to have so few ways of resolving it in ways that can make everyone happy. I don't expend a lot of energy on environmental politics. I wouldn't consider myself particularly an activist. But in watching things play out, I see the same things playing out that were playing out in the 1890s.
Yeah, and you make mention in the prologue to the book that our contemporary situation is we're in a phase where there's a considerable effort to take away public lands, make them private, exploit them. We just had a conversation about that
right.
with the Montana Conservation Voters. And, right now we have somebody who's the head of the Bureau of Land Management whose philosophy is get rid of it. Let's not have any public land, period. And when you look at the lives of these two men back in the 1890s, 1900s, early 1900s, they had the same kind of issues, but fought it from different points of view, I guess you could say. Pinchot, kind of an interesting character. He is not well understood. And, for example, maybe you can talk about this somewhat. You know, he was, I believe he's the one who got it, the fact that we have, park rangers and that we have Forest Service officials who wear uniforms and that sort of thing. He had a very distinct approach to it.
He was very into the professionalism of forestry. This was a fascinating sort of area that I discovered in this research. Was if you think about the late 1800s, this is a time of a growing of professions that doctors, lawyers, engineers are becoming not just, well, let me tinker with this, but there's a profession, there's a body of knowledge that I have to honor. And Pinchot really wanted foresters to fit in that profession as well. He established the Yale Forestry School as the nation's first graduate school in forestry. He established the U.S. Forest Service as an employer of professional foresters. He established the Society of American Foresters, one of those. He established a forestry professional society as sort of the equivalent of the AMA for doctors to enforce these professional standards. And to your point, he encouraged his employees to wear the uniforms and in other ways sort of exemplify that professionalism to the public.
Yeah, there are almost two sides of science, actually. Muir was interested in observing and cataloging and describing science, and it seemed to me Pinchot was often interested in the system of science and understanding the environment from that perspective.
Exactly, very much of a systems thinker. We have this science now, how can we apply it? How can we come up with the policies to make this work in the real world? And Muir as sort of this spiritual poet figure wasn't necessarily too worried about policy. What he wanted to do was to bring people to God by bringing them
right.
to nature. If he could get them out there, great. He really only got dragged into politics, dragged into even the Sierra Club, because friends convinced him that, gosh, you want people to get out in nature, there might not be any nature if we don't try to stand up for it.
Yeah, they both went through, I guess you could say, fights with Congress and various development interests that were already picking away or trying to do away with segments of the public lands because they wanted it for, a mine, or they wanted it to graze cattle on, and they were trying to balance that. They were a good team in a way. How long did that so-called team, I don't know, it's not really a team, but how long did it last? They were,
they first met in 1893, and they wrote very supportive letters to each other through the 1890s. They had this intense period of collaboration starting in the summer of 1896 and running through the spring of 97. They saw each other a few times later over the next 6 or 7 years. And then they started splitting in the mid to late 1900s, largely over the issue of the Hetch Hetchy Dam inside Yosemite Park.
That's an issue. You've mentioned that quite a bit in the book. For the people that are not familiar with it, what right. was the Hetch right. Hetchy controversy?
Yes, and I was one of those people, too, when I first got into this. I was like, oh, what a funny word. Hetch Hetchy is a valley inside Yosemite National Park, similar to but maybe slightly less spectacular than the main Yosemite Valley. And its name comes from a mispronunciation of a Miwok Indian word for a plant that they were harvesting when the first white people came across them in that valley. And it was incredibly remote back 120 years ago, which to Muir made it even more special. And the city of San Francisco proposed building a dam to provide drinking water to the city from the Hetch Hetchy Valley. And Gifford Pinchot, with his philosophy of the greatest good for the greatest number in the long run, decided that that was a pretty good deal. You had, I think, 500,000 people in San Francisco at the time. They were suffering from a monopolistic water provider that was gouging them, that would continue to gouge them. They had just suffered a huge, devastating fire that had destroyed the downtown. Water was a pretty important thing for a city, and to be able to create a reservoir that would be publicly owned as a progressive, Pinchot thought that was a pretty good deal. And Muir said, no, 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 this is inside a national park. This is special ground. This is something that we should not touch. We must preserve it. How can you take this away from us? And the people in San Francisco would be like, you know, how many people visit the Hetch Hetchy Dam, Hetch Hetchy Valley each year? It's maybe in the dozens, maybe the hundreds, versus 500,000 people needing drinking water. And so this is the classic preservation versus conservation fight. Are people part of nature and need drinking water from natural resources? Or is nature something special and better than corrupt human society? And every time we touch a place like a special place like a national park, we end up ruining it. The dam forces ended up winning that battle. The Hetch Hetchy Valley was dammed. And the following year, John Muir died. He was in his 70s. He'd lived a very rich life. His wife and many of his friends had also passed away. To me, it sounds like he died of old age. But to many of his disciples, it was as if Hetch Hetchy had killed him.
So that's I think we live next to Yellowstone First National Park. And we don't understand that actually the first real park of that kind was Yosemite, but it was a state park. And it had a peculiar history because it was a state park, and then they made a national park around it, and Hetch Hetchy was part of that. And then they fought over the state and the federal, you know.
I love this story, and we don't often tell it around here because we love Yellowstone so much. But, you know, in the 1860s, when the first white people came across Yosemite, they said, wow, this is amazing. We need to preserve this. Let's not just let it be homesteaded. Let's keep it as some sort of park. We'll give it to the state of California as a park. And the state said, great. And Congress said, great. And Yosemite was a park. And then several years later, 1872, the first white people come across Yellowstone. And they go, this is amazing. We need to preserve this. This needs to be some sort of park. Let's give it to the state of, uh-oh. Wyoming isn't a state yet. Montana isn't a state yet. They're territories. They're not set up to hold a park. I guess we have to hold it on the national level. And so the whole first national park thing was almost an accident.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't really have a vision for what a national park should be. And so 20 years later, when they set up the first national forest, they don't really have a vision for what the forest should be. Through the late 1800s, we did come up with the vision for Yellowstone that could match these wonderful landscapes. And through the 1890s and 1900s, Pinchot, with Muir's help, helped come up with that vision for the national forests, for public lands in general.
Now he's, I won't say solely, but largely responsible for the multi-use aspect of national forests, right? I mean, he understood
right.
that.
Right.
It was in part of his philosophy of how to deal with wilderness, and but he was, that's the word, amenable to commercial uses?
Absolutely. You know, he did not see capitalism as bad. He did not see use as bad. He believed that people needed timber, they needed water, they needed meat, they needed to use these places, these public lands, to provide for human needs. Muir was always a little bit vague. I mean, he was a philosopher. He didn't really have to deal with some of these nitty-gritty aspects of, you know, John, where did you get that wheat that made the bread that you're carrying on your trip? Well, I got it from home.
You had an interesting detail in the book, which I found kind of illuminating. Was you said that Muir didn't live off the land.
Right.
He didn't collect eat berries and you know, look for mushrooms, and he took up bread with him
right.
and ate bread. Right.
He had a famously small appetite, so he would take a hunk of bread and be out for 6 or 7 days. But he was out for 6 or 7 days just wandering around and being free. He wasn't foraging or living off the land, as you say. Because nature was something different. Nature, humans were not fit to be involved using natural resources that way. And yet, you know, at home, of course, he was using resources to make that bread. But somehow, his home he saw as not nature. And Pinchot had the more unified attitude that, well, you know, we're all in this planet together, and we all need to figure out how to use these things judiciously. And of course, how do you define judiciously? As soon as some of the more rapacious companies got into Pinchot's system, they had a different definition of judicious than he or some of the other activists might have.
Mm-hmm. Just for giggles, drag this forward into the modern age. I think you're probably familiar with some of the controversies around the Crazies, Crazy Mountains. And there is a movement afoot there to try to, on the one hand, make a wilderness area out of it, and the other is to try to make just an open access kind of, not a park necessarily, but these ideas of these two men, actually, you could take what they say and transfer it to what's happening with around the Crazy Mountains, and perfect analogies. You know, on the one hand, wilderness, purism, beauty,
right. That's
Muir. On the other hand, you have Pinchot saying, well, yeah, but yeah, they can bring some cows up there, and you know, that give and take, you know.
Right.
Are you familiar with that, or the?
You know, I'm not familiar with a lot of the details about the Crazies, but what I will say is that it is a lot more complicated now because, you know, Pinchot was basically managing for timber, maybe also for things like water and grazing. But his chief concern was, can we have a sustained timber yield for the next 20, 50 years? And today we have so many more interests. Pinchot just didn't know much about ecology, about habitat. Now we realize that what animals need in order to survive. And so now we feel some need to manage for those values as well. Now we have such higher demand for recreation and so many different types of recreation, that can be a little more damaging to some of the natural resource values. So the management challenge has become far more complex. But I do think, to affirm what you were saying, at the heart there is this sense of, well, yeah, maybe it should be wilderness, or yeah, maybe we should be using it. And that's something that we continually struggle to reconcile.
Yeah, and I think that's the point you actually come out with in the book. But by the end of it, you really kind of realize it's a give and take. Yeah. And not always easy.
Yeah.
And not always peaceful either.
Yeah, and the pendulum will swing, you know. One of the kids in the high school class today was asking about, you know, has it always been this struggle? And, I say, gosh, apparently in the 1950s, nobody had heard of John Muir. Gifford Pinchot and management was, when you think about the growth and management ethos of the 1950s, that makes a lot of sense. In the 1960s, yeah, suddenly
right.
You have,
exactly.
You know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, and John
Muir. Right,
Mayer.
Right. They went too far, and then they went too far. Right.
Oh, how do you look upon this whole situation now? And I'm being very specific and talking about the way the Trump administration is managing, I guess is the word, our public lands and the kind of controversy you talk about in the book. What's happening now? How do you see this?
So I'm actually going to push back a little bit on the sort of standard progressive interpretation of what's going on now. Someone like Ryan Zinke, I'm not a big fan of Ryan Zinke's policies. I think he in some ways was sort of abusing the public trust as he looked to do a lot more drilling on public lands. But he wasn't an enemy of public lands themselves. He still believed in federal government ownership of lands to be drilled. He just had a different set of priorities for how we're going to use these lands, different than some of the environmentalists do, different than historically what had been happening for the last 20, 30, 50 years. And so I think, you know, you can respond to Ryan Zinke by saying, well, actually, you know, maybe we don't need to drill quite that much. Maybe we want to place these other values, but thank you for your support of public lands. And I don't think that's what a lot of progressives have done. They've instead lumped Zinke in with what I would consider a fairly extremist small faction of people who are arguing for complete elimination of federally owned lands, this land transfer movement that would allegedly transfer public lands to the states. Certainly a frightening notion, but not one that I see has a great deal of support or really a great deal of practical possibility. You know, it's such an ideologically divided time that it's very easy to jump on one bandwagon or the other and vilify the other side. I do think that we need more conversations among people who disagree, the way that Muir and Pinchot needed to converse despite their disagreements. And we need those not only for issues like public land, but even the bigger issues facing us, such as climate change.
Yeah, unfortunately or otherwise, climate obviously doesn't enter into the discussion between Muir and Pinchot. I mean, they didn't even know about it. There was no such thing as climatology, and, you know.
Right.
They're, in fact, at the, I guess you could say, the dawn of the modern scientific age, you know.
And yet, you know, I think we are talking about climate these days because we perceive the huge environmental crisis that climate change would bring. We look at the potential extinctions. We look at the potential changes in weather that could cause, you know, differences in farming, that could cause hurricanes, that could cause huge economic damage, et cetera, et cetera. We look at the potential just misery that climate change would cause. And that, I think, is very similar to the 1890s. When they looked at the changes that they were facing, they saw a lot of environmental crisis and a lot of potential misery. If you think about the 1890s, this is when the bison were nearly extinct. Everyone expected bison to go extinct within a few years. The passenger pigeon had gone extinct. Elk seemed to be headed toward extinction. There was this notion that farms and progress and human population would just chew up the entire country. There might not be wildlife.
Right. Well, and there was evidence of that happening.
It was happening. It was a real fear of extinctions and environmental degradation. We mentioned the timber famine earlier. A real fear that I think felt to them much like our fear feels to us today. And that was coupled with, this was the era of the robber barons. This was the era of incredible income inequality and a system that seemed to be rigged against the middle and lower classes. And the things like homesteading that had been sort of a release valve for the middle classes to have their opportunity to gain a farm. That worked pretty well in the Midwest in the 1860s and 70s. By the 1890s, that whole model has fallen apart. The only lands available for homesteading are the incredibly dry lands in the far west that small amount of acreage isn't going to work anymore. There was an increasing amount of homestead fraud. People were taking up homesteads and turning them over to large ranchers or to large timber companies that would then come in and...
Corruption.
Strip out the resources, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of familiar with what we see happening today.
And so how are we going to deal with this? If you're living in the 1890s, you're seeing this corruption, you're seeing this... It just feels hopeless. And why would you even talk to this rich, privileged person, well-educated DC insider who comes out and says, yeah, I know what's best for the West, whether that's Gifford Pinchot or Theodore Roosevelt. There were a lot of the tensions back then that we are seeing now.
Mm-hmm.
And I might add one more, an incredibly dysfunctional Congress. They had allowed the president to set aside forest reserves, but they hadn't given the president any direction on what to do with those reserves or any budget to do it with. And everyone who knew anything, all the scientists, all the proto-scientists of that era, were saying to Congress, you have to have a forest policy. And Congress just couldn't do it.
Didn't have a clue what that meant.
Right.
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 And were so caught up in their own petty little fights that they wouldn't pay attention to it. And so Pinchot and Muir and a bunch of other people got together and said, well, you know, we need to come up with some solutions on our own. And not just one political wing's solution. We need to sort of replicate the processes of democracy, of talking to people we disagree with and forging a solution that will work for everybody and bring that to Congress. And that's the story that I tell in the book of how they did that to bring in this, not only the 1897 law that established the legal foundation of public lands, but also the public will, the public support for the idea of public lands. Muir was sure that this law, if it ever passed, would be immediately destroyed by the next presidential administration. And yet it was Muir's rhetorical gifts that helped convince the public that this was a good idea, such that any politician who dared try to mess with forest reserves after that would have been just laughed away.
Yeah, it was an interesting change of attitude, I think, which occurred back then.
Right, yeah.
Complicated. It's a complex one. I would say, as a reader of the book, that you present a lot of these complexities very well.
Thank you.
And it is more than just a biography or a snapshot of that era. It's many of the issues and complexity of... They had to deal with so many different pieces, and just like we do now in many respects, so... it's an interesting book. I'd highly recommend it. Again, the name is the title of the book, The Natural Rivals,
right,
which you go into some detail as why you called it Rivals, but I
won't necessarily... I had a reviewer say, Mr. Clayton is surely the only person ever to compare John Muir and Gifford Pinchot to Larry Bird and Magic Johnson. And I was very proud of that. I had some of my early readers were like, do you really want to make this metaphor? And I said, yes, absolutely, that the rivalry of Bird and Magic put the NBA on the map in the 1980s. People became fans of basketball because they loved that rivalry. And I think people became fans of public lands and natural environments because of the rivalry of Muir and Pinchot.
Yeah. In our context, how many times do we wish we had rivalries instead of enemies?
Right. Right. And we're so addicted to conflict that we see a lot of relationships as enemies, as conflicts, rather than as rivalries or as constructive conflict.
Right.
So with that, John Clayton, thank you very much. I appreciate the time you took. I know you have a really busy schedule today, and an hour or so, you're going to be, not a couple hours, but you'll be at Elk River Bookstore and giving a presentation there.
What a delight to spend this time with you guys. Charming conversation and a smart one, which is my favorite kind.
Thank you.
So thank you.
All right, thank you.
Well, we thank John Clayton for that interview. It's interesting, today we also had the Montana Conservation Voters in here, and we're really talking about very related subjects, the preservation of the land and the necessity of trying to defend it from people who want to use it for things that will destroy it as opposed to use it to keep it. And these are the issues that are brought up in his book. And
Right, and there's a lot of parallels between what was happening at the end of the last century, at the beginning of the last century, and what's happening right now.
Yeah, it was.
It's very interesting.
What they called the Gilded Age, and it was the extreme contrast between the very wealthy and the very poor, and part of what role does the government actually play in particularly in this case in land? We're talking about national parks, national forests,
robber barons.
Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting book, interesting period of time, and I thank him for taking the time to talk with us. And so, that being said, thank you very much for listening. This has been a podcast, Runs Through It, coming to you from Sound Color Studios in downtown Livingston. Thank you very much.